Welcome to the 21st. I'm Gwen Macsai. Today's show is all about love because, in case you forgot or would like to forget, tomorrow is Valentine's Day. And we don't air on Fridays. Later this hour, we'll hear from Illinois musicians Vivian McConnell, also known as Vivi Lightbody, and Sean Newman from the band Rat Boys about their favorite love songs and possibly a heartbreak song or two. Plus, an Illinois man who's married over 1,000 couples weighs in with some of his favorite stories. But first, we're going to delve into the psychology of love. What's the difference between loving someone and just liking them, as they say in middle school? How do some people in our lives achieve that special status as our one and only, while others, you know, not so much? We're going to get into this and other questions with our guest, Frank McAndrew. He's a professor of psychology at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois. He studies human and social behavior from an evolutionary perspective. I guess that means how we got here to where we are. Professor McAndrew, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here again.
All right, so let's just start with the basics. What's the difference between loving someone and really, really liking them? And or what's the difference between a crush and love?
Great questions. And there is a tendency, right, to think about love as liking on steroids, right? If you really, really, really like somebody, then you love them. But it turns out they're really quite different animals. It's perfectly easy to like someone and just not feel that, the chemistry, even though it's really psychology. and at the same time, there are, of course, movies are made about people who are drawn to each other in a very dramatic way, and they don't seem to like each other very much. So they're very, very different. I think there's a biological component to love that you don't have with liking. You can like somebody because they're nice, they're pleasant, they share your views on things, they're generous, but there's no adrenaline. And so I think that romantic attraction we feel for other people is the pleasure center in our brain firing, and there's adrenaline in our system, and we just feel it.
But what about right? But what about a crush in love? Because a crush feels like you're whacked out in love, and then, you know, years later you take a look back and think, that was just a crush. But it feels like love.
Sure. Yeah, and we usually use the word infatuation to describe something like that. Social psychologists who study love actually make distinctions between many different types of love. And the type of love you're describing there is just pure passion. It's all physical. The other kinds of love that we can think about are the kinds that sort of grow over time. So a couple of people who've been married for a very long time, for example, their lives are completely intertwined. Maybe that fire isn't there like it once was, but they are very much deeply in love. So you need both components for the whole picture.
And is it possible to actually study what draws us to another person? I mean, is it explainable / studyable?
Well, you can certainly look at what kinds of things people respond to in singles ads, for example, to find out what kinds of features attract attention from men and women. You can certainly ask people to rate how much they value different things in a romantic partner. So, yes, as a psychologist, I guess I would argue you can measure just about anything if you do it right.
But you have to admit, I think, that everybody's definition of love is very different. So we're trying to study something that's just so subjective. Everybody uses one word to describe so many different feelings, I think.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Yes. No, you're right. I think, again, whether you want to call these different things love versus other things or call them different types of love. So I think the distinction that psychologists usually make is between sort of companionate love and passionate love, the one that has the oomph and the adrenaline going versus the one that just has the deep caring.
Yeah, I heard someone once describe that as, what was it? Like, I think romantic love and domestic love. Was that a euphemistic way to put it?
Those would be good labels. One sounds a lot tamer than the other.
Right.
Certainly. But yeah, lots of times people think that this is a more rational process than it is. One of the standard letters that you see to advice columns comes from somebody who usually signs it something like "nice guy in Toledo," and he is complaining about what a gentleman he is, how well he treats women, and time and time again, they just don't seem interested and they go for the bad boy. And he feels cheated. You know, he feels like he's done everything right and he's not getting that love reward that he thinks he deserves. He just doesn't realize he's boring. I mean, there's no adrenaline there. And, you know, a woman can't force herself to feel that. It's either there or it isn't. As a matter of fact, there was an ancient Roman expert on love, Ovid, who wrote a manual for young men about how to win the affections of young women. And one of his bits of advice was to take them to the gladiatorial contests. Apparently, the idea was if they're sitting there watching all of this gruesome stuff, that makes their heart beat faster and their adrenaline is racing through their system. And maybe they think it's because of this guy I'm with.
I guess we can't do that anymore.
Well, there are equivalent things, though. You can take people on roller coasters and scary movies and do things that might get the heart beating a little faster.
Interesting. So I want to talk about something that is actually the opposite of love and attraction, particularly because I think that you study it, and that is creepiness. And so can you explain what makes somebody creepy?
Well, sure. Creepiness is not the same as some of the other emotions we think of. It's not the same as fear. If you're afraid of something, you know that there's a danger. You know what it is. You know what you should do to try to escape from it. If you're disgusted by something, you recognize disgust for what it is. Creepiness is this uncomfortable feeling of just not knowing whether there's something to be afraid of or not. And we can be creeped out by places. We can be creeped out by people. So to use people as an example, if you're interacting with somebody and there's something about it that's just really off, the eye contact isn't the way it should be, the person is steering the conversation in uncomfortable directions, a lot of their other nonverbal behaviors are just really odd, it could be just an awkward person. And so it would be rude for you to sort of run away screaming. But on the other hand, this is a person who obviously doesn't understand some rules of social interaction. So what other rules doesn't this person understand? So we become hypervigilant. We feel trapped in this situation, wallowing in our discomfort, trying to figure out if this person is a threat or not. And men, of course, are creepier to most people than women are because they're simply
more. I'm glad you said it, not me.
Yeah, no, it's been confirmed in several studies over and over again. Men feel the same way. When you ask somebody to describe the prototypical creepy person, both men and women immediately think of a man.
Yeah. So here's something that's always bugged me, and I want to ask you about it. Everybody seems to hold up the idea of a perfect relationship, even though all evidence is to the contrary. I mean, 50% divorce rate, nobody you know has a perfect relationship. And yet there's this like constant societal thing, like if you only work hard enough or if you only marry the right person, it'll be perfect. And it just, we all kind of want to believe in it, but nobody really does. And I'm wondering, is there like a biological kind of need to hold something out there as the attainable, unattainable?
Well, I do think we are optimists. And I, from an evolutionary perspective, I think this is very adaptive. Another way to think about this question is think about how often you've heard somebody say, "Wasn't it great when?" Or, "Won't it be great when?" But you never hear anybody say, "Isn't this great right now?"
So true.
We tend to look at the past and the future through rose-colored glasses. We remember our younger years as being, we forget all the boring stuff and the stressful stuff. We remember the good times. And if you think the future is going to be better, it keeps you striving. And so maybe you just got divorced for the third time and have had some bad experiences, And if you just give up, you are going to get outcompeted. But the optimist is the person who says, well, I didn't get it right that time. If I keep striving, it can happen. And so that person is going to pursue relationships and reproduce. And those genes are the ones that came down through the ages. The pessimist that just gave up, those genes appeared pretty quickly.
That's funny. Well, that reminds me, my sister once told me, I don't know if she's trying to get me to get married or scare me off from getting married, but she said, I never knew such depths of love, hate, and patience until I got married and had children. That I come from a very like down-to-earth cynical family, just saying. So another thing we know you study is sort of equity in a relationship, in that, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, we believe that we live in an equitable society. We want 50-50 parenting and 50-50 chores and everything, but ultimately a lot of relationship duties fall along gender lines. And I'm wondering why sort of male dominant couples are still so common despite our efforts to make them otherwise.
Well, that's
in a heterosexual couple.
Yeah.
Or just one person being dominant.
Well, they're dominant. I mean, yes, you can have relationships where one person just completely dominates and bosses the other person around. But more often, they're dominant in different spheres of life. One of them, you know, handles the money. The other one makes decisions about what's going to happen with the family. And so I think the equity in a relationship works not because everybody is splitting everything 50-50, but each one is in charge of sort of an equal number of things, so that they have their turn at feeling like they're the one in control, they're the one in power. But the kinds of things people disagree about in marriages, you know, how to treat the children, how to spend the money, it's a balancing act. That's why the divorce rate is so high.
Yeah.
And I think the unrealistic expectations we have play into that as well.
There's the perfect thing again.
Yeah. And also, the way we do marriage now in human history is a fairly recent thing. For most of human history, marriage was kind of a business arrangement between families. Everybody recognized that people had these passionate attractions to each other. But they also recognize that these are kind of fleeting and they come and go. And to base sort of a lifelong commitment on one of those was sort of foolish. So you had these arranged marriages and hopefully affection grows over time. But the marriage wasn't about the love. It was about other things. And so the romantic ideals that now kind of run our lives put these two things together in a way that sets us up for failure in some ways, I think.
All right. Well, we're running low on time, but I have one last question. Most of us come from kind of crazy families because most families are crazy. And yet we all go on, many of us go on to have families of our own. That has got to be a biological imperative. That are we just hardwired to think that we're going to do a better job?
I don't think we think about it. I mean, you fall in love, children come along. You don't sit down, I didn't at least, and rationally plot out, here are the ways in which I'm going to be a better parent than my parents, and okay, so I'm going to go ahead and have kids. I just don't think we're always a little behind the curve. We're always trying to catch up with what we've already done.
Oh, okay. So then before we go, do you have any general but sage advice for our listeners about love or relationships on this eve of Valentine's Day? Quickly.
Wow. Having my wife know that I gave that kind of advice would be very interesting. No, just we all need a little love in the dead of winter like this. So think of this as a day where you're entitled to indulge yourself.
Oh, that's so nice. That's a wonderful sentiment to end on. That is Knox College psychology professor Frank McAndrew. Frank, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Coming up after the break, we're speaking to some of our favorite Illinois musicians about relationships, love, and heartbreak, and how some of our worst times make for our best music.
just to get close to you. Could burn something today. And I'll run for miles just to get a taste.
First is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.